Parents on Freedom. The Foundation for Economic Education is pleased to share with you the proceedings of September 30th, 1989. The two presentations given by Robert James Bitonato and M. Stanton Evans at the Conference on Freedom during the afternoon, and Dr. Bruce Evans' address at the inaugural dinner of the Leonard E. Reed Society. Both events were held at the Tarrytown Conference Center in Tarrytown, New York, and were attended by approximately 100 trustees, staff, and friends of the Foundation for Economic Education. Some of the presentations have been slightly edited. Robert James Bitonato, whose three-part series on crime and consequences appeared in the July, August, and September 1989 issues of The Freeman, is a staff writer for Reader's Digest and a journalist and lecturer who specializes in cultural and political issues. He is the author of Getting Away with Murder in the July 1988 Reader's Digest, which, during the 1988 presidential election campaign, stirred a national controversy about crime and the Massachusetts prison furlough program. Many observers credit this article with affecting the outcome of the presidential race. Mr. Bitonato's many articles, essays, book, and film reviews have appeared in Reader's Digest, Success, The Boston Herald, The American Spectator, The Intellectual Activist, Reason, and other publications. He is also a frequent public speaker and talk show guest. Here now is Mr. Bitonato's presentation, Crime and Consequences in a Free Society.
My involvement with a crime issue began with that Reader's Digest article titled Getting Away with Murder, the piece that made famous the name of Willie Horton. The Horton incident not only contributed to the demise of a presidential candidate, it also heightened public awareness of a whole approach to crime which has gained sway over the past three decades. It certainly enlightened me. My investigation of the Horton fiasco exposed me to virtually every element of the criminal justice system, most importantly, to crime victims. Their faces have haunted my dreams and impelled me to continue learning about the system to this day. Here I can touch only briefly on a few aspects of what I've learned. Before making some personal observations, I'd like to summarize for you what I wrote in my Freeman series, Crime and Consequences. Crime is increasing rapidly with no end in sight. From 1964 to 1980, the property crime rate increased 2.5 times, while the rate of violent crime tripled. In the decade that followed, from 1979 to 1978, the number of property crimes increased an additional 12%, while the number of violent crimes skyrocketed another 30%. And even these statistics paint too rosy a picture, for they're based only on reported crimes. The American Bar Association recently estimated that the actual number of serious crimes is some 2.5 times greater than official figures indicate. How has the criminal justice system handled this crime explosion? Well, if we adjust the official statistics to account for unreported crimes, we find that there is only one arrest for every 13 serious crimes committed. That's arrests. And only about 1.7% of the most serious felonies committed in 1986 resulted in imprisonment. In fact, the percentage of crimes punished by imprisonment is 32% lower, it was 32% lower in 1986 than it was in 1960. And this despite a doubling of prison populations in those years. In other words, this means that crime is increasing far faster than we've been willing or able to build prisons for the new criminals. And even if he's finally imprisoned, the typical criminal serves merely a fraction of his nominal sentence. Last year's campaign ad showing a revolving door of incoming inmates immediately returning to the streets is more truth than exaggeration. Now, what has spawned the unprecedented crime explosion of recent decades? What has caused revolving door justice? Why do many crime victims feel that the worst offenses against them occur after they enter the courtroom? I attribute blame for all of this to what I call the excuse-making industry. Now, this industry consists primarily of intellectuals in the social science establishment whose theories of criminal causation have shaped the modern legal system. It also consists of an activist wing of social workers, counselors, therapists, defense attorneys, and numerous politically progressive hangers-on. The excuse-making industry is a sprawling intellectual consensus united on a single premise, that the individual criminal isn't responsible for his behavior. Whether we treat criminals punitively or therapeutically depends upon the issue of criminal responsibility, whether the individual has control of his actions. For if the individual is not responsible, then we shouldn't engage in what the famous psychiatrist Carl Menninger denounced as the crime of punishment. Now, excuse makers all share the deterministic view that man is not a causal agent in any primary sense, that human action must be explained by reference to causes allegedly beyond the individual's control. The criminal should be forgiven or placed in a better environment or counseled to better cope with his inner demons. But under no circumstances should he be held accountable or punished for what he couldn't help. As criminologist James Q. Wilson and Richard Herrnstein wrote, quote, "The modern liberal position on criminal justice is rehabilitative, not retributive, because the offender is believed to have been driven to his crimes rather than to have committed them freely and intentionally," close quote. As early as 1949, the Supreme Court stated, quote, "Retribution is no longer the dominant objective of the criminal law. Reformation and rehabilitation of offenders have become important goals of criminal jurisprudence," close quote. During the 1960s, the excuse makers managed to rout the last of those who believed that the criminal justice system's purpose was to apprehend and punish criminals. Their aims were perhaps best expressed by former U.S. Attorney General Ramsey Clark in his influential 1970 book, Crime in America. Quote, "The day, if there ever was one, when vengeance could have any moral justification, passed centuries ago. Punishment as an end in itself is itself a crime in our times. The use of prisons to punish only causes crime. Rehabilitation must be the goal of modern corrections. Every other consideration should be subordinated to it." Close quote. With the excuse maker's triumph, government was no longer to be society's impartial umpire, but rather its meddling therapist. In the heady days of the New Frontier and the Great Society, prisons were renamed correctional facilities, and a wave of prison reforms arose, coinciding with massive government social spending programs intended to eradicate the supposed causes of crime. All this occurred within an increasingly chaotic cultural environment in which various liberation movements ridiculed and reviled common sense, moral, intellectual, and educational standards. Soon, the most depraved behavior, from drug abuse to hostage taking to rioting, was blessed, excused, or romanticized by various members of the excuse-making industry. This all had a major impact on the crime rate. Ernest Vandenhaag has noted that U.S. crime rates had declined during the 19th century and all the way up to the 1960s. Between 1960 and 1975, however, crime skyrocketed 232%. Homicide rates doubled, burglaries tripled, robberies more than tripled. Yet during this same period, the number of people in prison actually declined. The number of federal and state prisoners in 1960 was 213,000. By 1970, despite a doubling of the crime rate during that period, the total was down to 196,000. The probability that a felony would result in imprisonment decreased fivefold. Vandenhaag concluded, quote, clearly, crime rose rapidly between 1960 and 1980 because the severity and frequency of punishment declined, close quote. Charles Murray agrees, quote, the changes in welfare and changes in the risks attached to crime and changes in the educational environment reinforced each other. Together, they radically altered the social incentive structure. Soon, a thoughtful person watching the world around him was accurately perceiving a considerably reduced risk of getting caught. Besides their other negative effects, redistributionist programs also diverted badly needed funds away from the criminal justice system. Less than 3% of all government spending in the United States went to support civil and criminal justice activities in fiscal 1985. And less than 1% went to operate the nation's correctional system, including jails, prisons, probation, and parole. This has left police underfunded and undermanned to face the ever-mounting crime wave, court dockets flooded with impossible caseloads, jails and prisons filled to overflowing. It creates incentives to incarcerate as few criminals as possible and to release them as quickly as possible. Thus, the excuse-making industry undermined the criminal justice system both morally and practically. But the excuse-makers marched on undaunted, offering an array of rationales for the crime wave rising in their wake. Perhaps the most popular of these was the sociological excuse. Ramsey Clark, again, offered a long-winded summary of the view that crime is caused by social and economic factors. Quote, if we're to deal meaningfully with crime, what must be seen is the dehumanizing effect on the individual of slums, racism, ignorance, and violence, of corruption and impotence to fulfill rights, of poverty and unemployment and idleness, of generations of malnutrition, of congenital brain damage and prenatal neglect, of sickness, disease, pollution, decrepit, dirty, ugly, unsafe, overcrowded housing, of alcoholism and narcotics addiction, of avarice, anxiety, fear, hatred, hopelessness, and injustice. These are the fountainheads of crime, close quote. A more mercifully concise summary of this view came in the musical The West Side Story, where a juvenile delinquent explains to the local cop, Officer Krupke, we're depraved on account of we're deprived, close quote. The sociological excuse defies common sense and empirical evidence. Despite decades of constantly improving living conditions for the vast majority of people, crime today is increasing. And ironically, it's increasing faster in America and other developed countries than in most poor parts of the world. Moreover, even within the same poor inner-city families, some youngsters become criminals while their siblings do not. Sociology can't explain such diversity in individual behavior under identical circumstances. Wilson and Herrnstein also note that, quote, during the 1960s, one neighborhood in San Francisco had the lowest income, the highest unemployment rate, the highest proportion of families with incomes under $4,000 a year, the least educational attainment, the highest tuberculosis rate, and the highest proportion of substandard housing of any area of the city. That neighborhood was called Chinatown. Yet in 1965, there were only 5 persons of Chinese ancestry committed to prison in the entire state of California. Close quote. If poverty doesn't cause crime, why do prisons contain such a high proportion of poor people? I suggest not that poverty causes crime, but that criminality causes poverty. Irresponsibility is an almost sure path both to criminality and to poverty. Irresponsible people tend to be self-indulgent and short-range in their outlook. They drop out of school, develop unsavory associations, drink, gamble, abuse drugs, malinger, or simply refuse to work. These are hardly habits that lead to upward mobility, or which keep one out of trouble. And with criminality comes a host of additional problems which tend to keep the person at the bottom rungs of society. Character, it has been said, is destiny. It should come as no surprise, then, that prisons hold a concentration of people who are both criminal and poor. But it was their criminality which caused their poverty, not the other way around. Now, why do racial minorities constitute an unusually high share of the inmate population? Well, until the 1960s, crime was not a particularly severe problem among racial minorities. But ironically, as social welfare programs targeted at minorities rapidly expanded, irresponsible behavior within these groups, including criminality, simultaneously soared. In his book, Losing Ground, Charles Murray presents overwhelming evidence that welfare programs foster negative attitudes toward work, thrift, independence, property, self-respect, and self-responsibility. The unusually high incarceration rate of minorities stems from the pernicious consequences of welfare statism, which warps moral incentives for its presumed beneficiaries. Finally, the sociologist deprivation theory can't explain why white-collar crime is increasing as fast as street crime. From 1978 to 1987, forgery and counterfeiting went up 23.5%, fraud soared 41.8%, and embezzlement skyrocketed 56.3%. Such crimes are not typically perpetrated by those languishing in public housing projects. Clearly, white-collar criminals aren't depraved on account of their deprived. To excuse criminals because of poor social environments leaves unexplained the crimes of those from good social environments, and it insults millions from poor backgrounds who do not turn to crime. Now, while the sociological excuse for criminality blamed overwhelming forces outside the criminal, the psychological excuse blames irresistible forces inside the criminal. This excuse is the legacy of the father of psychoanalysis, Sigmund Freud. Freud authored the view that the individual can't help himself because he's driven by dark inner forces, and that the frustration of these drives is the source of mental illness. Quote, "I feel that the irrational forces in man's nature are so strong that the rational forces have little chance of success against them," unquote. To Freud, human nature was at root virtually criminal. Quote, "Every individual is virtually an enemy of civilization. Men are creatures among whose instinctual endowments is to be reckoned a powerful share of aggressiveness. As a result, their neighbor tempts them to satisfy their aggressiveness on him, to use him sexually without his consent, to seize his possessions, to humiliate him, to cause him pain, to torture him, and kill him." Close quote. The Freudian approach is the cornerstone of the excuse-making industry's to efforts to rehabilitate criminals. But how effective has it been in actually rehabilitating anyone? Well, in 1959, psychologist Hans Eysenck analyzed 19 reports covering 7,000 psychiatric patients from 1927 to 1951, and he found that the rate of improvement or cure was only 64%. Yet the spontaneous recovery rate for patients receiving no psychotherapy was 66%. How about psychotherapy's effectiveness in rehabilitating criminals? In the most ambitious study to date, Robert Martinson and two associates surveyed 31 criminal rehabilitation programs involving 400,000 inmates over 25 years. These employed Freudian psychoanalysis and related techniques to try to reduce criminal recidivism rates, that is, the percentage of inmates who, once released, will return to crime. The conclusion, quote, "With few and isolated exceptions, the rehabilitative efforts that have been reported so far have had no appreciable effect on recidivism," close quote. Disenchantment with Freudianism has fostered competing theories, the foremost being behaviorism. In its purest form, as in the theories of B.F. Skinner, behaviorism proposes an almost mechanical model of human action. Man is little more than a stimulus-response machine, like a rat or a pigeon, instead of a conscious thinking entity with some power of choice. This view of the behaviorist claim is objective and scientific because it ignores the subjective inner life of the individual. Thus, they focus on modifying an individual's behavior by conditioning him with rewards and punishment, which they call reinforcers. Now, whereas the Freudian psychology approach is the foundation for the therapeutic approach to crime, Behaviorism reinforces the sociological approach. Behaviorism buttresses such environmental excuses for criminality as poverty, peer pressure, racism, and, of course, the profit motive. However, so-called behavior modification programs for criminals don't seem to work any better than mining their Oedipus complexes. One major study examined 24 programs to alter the behavior of delinquent youths by means of rewards and punishments. Almost all succeeded while the youths remained institutionalized. But when four of the programs followed up on their subjects after their return to the community, they reported no lasting reduction of the young criminals' recidivism rates. Even criminals, it seems, are more complex than pigeons. Behaviorism and denying any motivational role for an individual's thinking and values joins conventional psychology as another failed theory of human action. The psychological excuse assumes that emotions are causally irreducible and irresistible. In effect, it equates all desires with compulsions. But if desires were irresistible, all weight loss clinics would close their doors, no one would be monogamous, and the alarm clock would never have been invented. The existence of civilization, however, provides abundant evidence that we do have some power, at some level, to choose which emotions will prove decisive. Other excuses for criminality claim that one may be racially, genetically, or physiologically predisposed toward criminality. And certain physical attributes have been shown statistically to correlate with increased criminality, such as being male, lower than average intelligence, hyperactivity, and heavy bone muscularity. But as Wilson and Herrnstein point out after examining that evidence, they said while the average offender tends to be constitutionally distinctive, he's not extremely or abnormally so, and thus any link to criminal behavior is statistically weak. And more importantly, a correlation is not a cause. Neither the sociological, psychological, nor biological excuses for crime adequately explains human action. Like the characters in the fable of the blind man and the elephant, each member of the excuse-making industry grabs onto one part of human nature or of society and then assumes that it constitutes or explains the whole. But all deny the free will and personal responsibility of the individual. The issue of free will versus determinism is the key to resolving any argument about the causes and cures of crime. For the sake of brevity, I won't go into that argument. I did that in my series, Crime and Consequences, and I believe booklets containing that will be available to you. But I simply end with a comment that it's no wonder that the excuse makers have failed to reform criminals by not taking into account the criminal's free will. They ignore the very factor which is decisive to his criminality. Determinism has led to, as one historian put it, a culture of instinctive sympathy for the devil, a feeling that criminals in this society are as much victims as victimizers, as much sinned against as sinners, if not more so. Close quote. Hence the excuse maker's curious double standard. Sympathy for the devil, but relative indifference toward crime victims. If no one can help being what he is, then the usually lucky and privileged middle-class crime victim merits only our marginal concern. However, the unlucky and underprivileged criminal is a chronic victim of circumstance and deserves our full sympathy and compassion. The logic of determinism, then, requires an inversion of traditional justice. Thus, excuse makers see constitutional rights not as a shield to protect the innocent from predators, but as a buffer between the victimized criminal class and the injustice of punishment. On June 13, 1966, the Supreme Court rendered its famous Miranda versus Arizona decision, which twisted beyond recognition the Fifth Amendment's prohibition against compelling the accused to testify against himself. The court held that even voluntary, uncoerced confessions by a suspect in police custody would no longer be admissible as evidence unless the police first warned him that, one, he had the right to remain silent, two, that anything he said might be used against him in court, three, that he had the immediate right to a lawyer, and four, he could get a free lawyer if he couldn't afford one. The suspect then didn't expressly waive those rights. All police questioning had to stop. And if police made the slightest misstep, and this procedural minuet, any confession obtained would be thrown out of court. This single decision overturned the convictions of four veteran criminals who voluntarily confessed to serious crimes. Chief Justice Earl Warren wrote for the majority that even though these confessions weren't, quote, involuntary in traditional terms, in none of these cases did the officers undertake to afford the appropriate safeguards to ensure that the statements were truly the product of a free choice, unquote. Now, how could these voluntary admissions be regarded as coerced? Quote, in each of the cases, the defendant was thrust into an unfamiliar atmosphere and run through menacing police interrogation procedures, close quote. The court conceded that, quote, to be sure, the records do not evince overt physical coercion or patent psychological ploys. But, as dissenting Justice Byron White angrily noted, quote, in the court's view, in-custody interrogation is inherently coercive, close quote. Justice John Harlan added, quote, one is entitled to feel astonished that the Constitution can be read to produce this result, close quote. Now, thanks to Miranda, police are obliged to buck up a nervous suspect's flagging resistance and nagging conscience with repeated reassurances about his right not to cooperate. In effect, the court construed the Constitution to protect a criminal even from his own guilty conscience. The cost of such procedural utopianism lies not just in convictions dismissed and overturned, but in confessions never made. 40% of murder convictions depend upon voluntary confessions by the perpetrator. It's crucial, then, that the police be allowed to ask questions without first begging the suspect's permission and encouraging his resistance. And yet, Miranda equates questions with coercion. Other kinds of evidence may be excluded from the courtroom, too, under what are known as exclusionary rules. Now, here's a representative case. In 1964, a 14-year-old girl was brutally murdered in New Hampshire. Under then-existing law, the police obtained from the state attorney general a search warrant for the home of the prime suspect. The evidence they found led to his conviction, but the Supreme Court ruled that the attorney general, as a prosecutor, was not impartial and could not issue search warrants. The incriminating evidence from the search was thrown out and the conviction overturned. Thanks to the exclusionary rules, up to 55,000 serious criminal cases are dropped annually, according to the Bureau of Justice Statistics. These criminals are free to prey on innocence again. Half of those set loose on exclusionary rule grounds have been rearrested within 2 years. Courts are supposed to determine truth and administer justice. That can't happen if facts, however obtained, are selectively excluded from fact-finding proceedings. Yet because the excuse-making industry regards those driven to crime as victims, matters of truth and justice are subordinated to a complex procedural etiquette on their behalf. Another symptom of this is lenient bail policies. In many jurisdictions, a judge can deny bail if a defendant has a criminal record or poses a danger to society or is likely to flee. But due to overcrowded cells, many judges try to minimize the number of defendants held in jail. I could cite many instances of what happens when an individual is released on bail and then goes out and commits other horrendous crimes. And such incidents aren't rare. 35% of repeat felons who are freed on bail either violate their release conditions, fail to reappear for trial, or are arrested for new crimes during the bail period. And that figure includes only known violations. Excuse-making civil libertarians notwithstanding, bail is not a fundamental human right. It's a means to an end. Like the right to vote, it's a contextual procedural right whose only purpose is to secure the substantive rights of life, liberty, and property. To defend bail for repeat offenders is again to subordinate the system's ends to its means. And then there's plea bargaining. Today, 80 to 90% of all convictions stem from negotiated guilty pleas, invariably to reduce charges, finagled between prosecutors and defense attorneys, and rubber-stamped by judges.
End of Part 1, Side 1, A Conference on Freedom. To continue, turn the cassette over. Part 1, Side 2, A Conference on Freedom. Continuing, Crime and Consequences in a Free Society. By Robert James Bidinotto.
Wisconsin Circuit Court Judge Ralph Adam Fine describes plea bargaining as essentially a bribe to the defendant, a payoff for a guilty plea, to entice him not to bother everyone with a trial. As a reward, serious charges are reduced, and inconvenient facts are ignored in court. Plea bargaining is also a ruse by which judges and lawyers skirt tough new mandatory sentencing laws. Charges are simply reduced in advance to avoid the harsher penalties. Such cynical maneuvers allow criminals to evade the full penalties of their actual crimes by receiving reduced punishment or probation. They permit lazy prosecutors to enhance their political careers by boasting of high conviction rates. They let defense attorneys quickly handle a large number of clients and collect a large number of fees without ever having to prepare for trial. And they help harried judges quickly clear their clogged court calendars and jammed jails. It's the triumph of expediency over justice. The Supreme Court endorsed this odious practice, saying that if every criminal charge were subjected to a full-scale trial, the states and federal government would need to multiply by many times the number of judges and court facilities, close quote. But that's nonsense. In 1975, Alaska ended plea bargaining, and there was no sudden tidal wave of not guilty pleas and trials to swamp the system. A National Institute of Justice study reported that guilty pleas continued to flow in at nearly undiminished rates. Most defendants pled guilty even when the state offered them nothing in exchange for their cooperation. In fact, they found that the cases were processed even more rapidly. That's because they managed to save all the time in all of the negotiations. No-deals prosecution does not clog the court system. It incapacitates repeat offenders for longer periods and thus actually reduces caseloads in the long run. The quest for justice is also stymied by the court practices known as parole and probation. Parole is the release of a convict under periodic supervision after he served only a portion of his sentence. Probation is the conditional release of an individual found guilty of a crime, but as an alternative to incarceration. Both are progeny of the excuse-making industry. As one criminology text puts it, quote, parole can be considered as an extension of the rehabilitative and now reintegrative program of the prison, unquote. But do they rehabilitate? A RAND Corporation study found that half of those sentenced to probation in California were convicted of another crime within 3 years. The Bureau of Justice Statistics found that 42% of inmates arriving at state prisons in 1985 were on parole or probation for an earlier conviction at the time of their arrival. 28% would still have been in prison for the earlier offense had they served out their maximum terms. This means that thousands of people were needlessly subjected to robbery, assault, even murder, due to the early releases of convicted felons. Now, the ideological origins of parole and probation are obvious. There are pragmatic considerations, too, like freeing up overcrowded jail and prison cells. And also, by holding out the carrot of early parole as a reward for good behavior, prison authorities hope to suppress inmate violence, though at the expense of public safety. Neither parole nor probation is justifiable practically nor morally. They fail to reduce recidivism, they undermine deterrence, and most importantly, they jeopardize public safety. They amount to playing Russian roulette with innocent human lives. If such policies seem demented, the last people to call for help are psychiatrists. Psychiatry can't really gauge the sanity of criminal defendants, let alone predict their future dangerousness, and yet psychiatrists testify as experts concerning a defendant's state of mind at the time of his crime. They determine whether or not he can grasp the charges against him and assist in his own legal defense. And they decide when he is cured and safe to return to society. Criminals found insane spend, on average, far less time in custody than those sent to prison for the same offenses. In New York, from 1965 to 1976, those acquitted of murder by reason of insanity and subsequently released from mental hospitals spent an average of less than a year and a half in custody. Similarly, murders found insane in New Jersey and Florida were released on average in just 2 and 3 years, respectively. Other studies have found that over a third of released criminal patients are rearrested. Stories of how criminal clever criminals manipulate psychiatrists are legendary, and I cite some of them in my article. A rather noted psychiatrist, Dr. Stanton Samanow, who worked with many of these individuals, dismisses the idea that perpetrators of ghastly crimes operate under some irresistible impulse or compulsion. Quote, from my clinical observations, I've concluded that kleptomaniacs and pyromaniacs are simply people who enjoy stealing or setting fires, close quote. Psychiatrist Lee Coleman warns that psychiatrists have no test to determine a person's innermost thoughts, even though courts assume they do. He argues that psychiatry should be stripped of its state-given powers by banning psychiatric testimony in legal proceedings, as well as abolishing the insanity and diminished capacity defenses. This still leaves us with the question, what to do with criminals? Misdirected by the excuse-making industry, previous crime control efforts have failed to consider the nature of the criminal himself. To reform the criminal justice and correctional systems, and we hope the criminal, we must first understand something about the criminal mind. Numerous empirical studies demonstrate that criminals simply don't think like non-criminals. Samanow describes a criminal mind thusly, quote, despite a multitude of differences in their backgrounds and crime patterns, criminals are alike in one way, how they think. All regard the world as a chessboard over which they have total control, and they perceive people as pawns to be pushed around at will. Trust, love, loyalty, and teamwork are incompatible with their way of life. They scorn and exploit most people who are kind, trusting, hardworking, and honest. Toward a few, they are sentimental, but rarely considerate. Some of their most altruistic acts have sinister motives, close quote. The criminal welcomes anything that aids in his predatory career, and in this, the excuse-making industry is invaluable to him. By concocting theories, policies, and programs which excuse irresponsibility, excuse makers have undermined any guilt feelings which might constrain criminal behavior. The sudden takeoff of crime during the heyday of moral relativism, the 1960s, is no accident. Now let's consider for just a brief moment the excuse makers' corruption of the so-called correctional system. Today's correctional facilities are designed for the outwardly mobile. Discipline has been relaxed and punishments largely banished. Inmates are to be enticed from their criminal ways through counseling and group therapy sessions, vocational and educational opportunities, and a host of programs for self-expression and entertainment and participation in various outside release programs such as furloughs and work release. This atmosphere is primarily a result of indeterminate sentencing provisions under which an inmate may be released on parole whenever authorities feel he's reformed. And today, not even a life sentence in virtually any state that you can cite really means life. The likelihood of early release on parole has shaped the entire prison environment. In essence, the plea bargaining process, which begins in the courtroom, extends into the prison itself. For their part, prison authorities make deals, extend privileges, tend to inmate grievances, and are rewarded with a relatively quiet prison population. In short, the carrots of outside release programs, special privileges, and ultimately early parole have replaced the disciplinary sticks of punishment in keeping the prison system running smoothly. The only casualties are truth and justice. Now, there might be some argument for the cynical atmosphere for the rehabilitation, if the rehabilitative approach had worked. But by the mid-1970s, a distressing realization hit home. This approach was failing universally and miserably. The reason is simple. Rehabilitation, as Samanow points out, quote, cannot possibly be effective because it is based on a total misconception. To rehabilitate is to restore to a former constructive capacity or condition. There is nothing to which to rehabilitate a criminal. There is no earlier condition of being responsible to which to restore him, close quote. Yet, rehabilitation's failure didn't stop the excuse-making industry. Instead, their ingenious solution was to rehabilitate inmates not behind prison walls, but out in the community. Hence, the so-called reintegration model with furloughs and work release and all of the kinds of things which I discuss in the part three of my series. Reintegration, of course, makes no more sense than traditional rehabilitation. Samanow also points out that it's absurd to speak of reintegrating him when he was never integrated in the first place. Nevertheless, every week, thousands of society's most vicious robbers, rapists, and killers participate in what is supposed to be an honor system, of unescorted leaves of absence from prison. Now, proponents typically claim relatively lower recidivism rates for participants in these programs, but you have to understand that the participants are pre-screened for admission into these programs. In other words, only the best ones get in. And that skews your statistical surveys at the outset. Statistics aside, the most compelling argument against these programs is their fundamental injustice, both to past and prospective crime victims. It's often claimed that such experiments, even if flawed, are no less successful than imprisonment and far less costly to society. These are false. After exhaustive review, Wilson and Herrnstein concluded, quote, however one measures crime, it is less common in places where sanctions are more likely. In one study of schoolboys, they found that the most restrictive punishments and most restrictive programs had the greatest impact on reducing recidivism. As for cost, the National Institute of Justice just released a 1987 study comparing the costs of prisons to the cost of having prisoners out on parole, probation, or in community release programs. And their survey found that inmates were committing an average of 187 crimes per year each while free, costing society an estimated $430,000 per criminal. This compares with only $25,000 a year to build a prison cell and keep a prisoner in it, and no victim. Behind bars during the 1980s would have cost us an additional $25 million a year, but it would have averted 187,000 crimes, costing society $430 million. But the moral issue is of overriding importance, and here the reintegration model is utterly indefensible. At the core of their defenses of all of these release programs, excuse makers believe that an occasional innocent victim is an acceptable loss. This cost-benefit approach is ethically appalling. It lets bureaucrats and politicians play God with innocent human lives. Hugh Haley of Ontario's John Howard Society, which advocates lenient parole for murderers, summed up the excuse maker's ethical premise bluntly. Quote, are we going to keep hundreds of people in jail just to save two or three? Close quote. Willie Horton's victim, Cliff Barnes, replied in a similar context, so we're expendable. Is that what they're saying? That, indeed, is what the excuse-making industry is saying, and that, in fact, is what the reintegration premise requires. If justice is truly to become a central focus of the criminal justice system, then I suggest the following reforms. First, no fact should ever be banished from criminal proceedings. All exclusionary rules concerning evidence and confessions should be eliminated. Second, career criminals and anyone with a history of escapes or failures to show in court should never get bail consideration. Third, every crime, no matter how petty, should merit some level of punishment, if only a fine, and if only to show that crime has inescapable consequences, something the criminal needs to learn. Plea bargaining should be abolished, and psychiatric testimony should be banned from the courtroom, as should the insanity and diminished capacity defenses. The legal fiction that the state is the victim of a crime must end, and victims should have full legal standing in court. All convicts should serve fixed, determinate sentences for their crimes. This would eliminate parole. In cases of premeditated murder where there's no question of guilt, capital punishment should be the standard sentence. Community-based corrections is just rehabilitation on the streets. The same failed approaches, but with the added opportunity of countless innocent victims. All of these programs should be ended on grounds of simple justice and public safety. Now we get to the issue of prison overcrowding, and perhaps one of the most controversial of my recommendations. The first solution, obviously, is to build more prisons. As the National Institute of Justice study indicated, that's far cheaper to society in the long haul than having these guys out in the streets. But much of the overcrowding problem is also due to laws on the books which shouldn't exist. Today, we have a terrible drug problem and an enormous drug-related crime problem. A large percentage of prison space and court time is occupied by those who've committed drug-related offenses. Many of those who are arrested for burglary, robbery, and larceny are drug addicts stealing to support expensive habits, habits which are expensive precisely because of the illegality of drugs. Being a hardliner on crime and drugs does not mean being quixotic and ineffectual. prohibitionism has never worked and never will. There are enormous profits in supplying illegal commodities at higher than market prices, something criminals are always willing to risk. Now, legalizing drugs, many fear, will lower their price and increase their availability, particularly to youngsters. But currently, countless youngsters, especially in inner cities, see drug dealing as their only hope for glamour and wealth. They're enticed by the high profits into the subterranean world of drug peddling and, ironically, of eventual drug use anyway. Legalization would strip away the profits and any illusions of glamour and success. It would end the present widespread seduction of youngsters into the drug world as suppliers. Perhaps this is something we could discuss in the question and answer period if anybody has any comments on it. I have a few final comments to make concerning the response to the series that I've had in the Freeman. A disturbing theme has arisen in a few critical letters I've received in response to the series, and I'd like to discuss them. Today, by any reasonable gauge, criminals pose a far more immediate and serious threat to most of us than do our government officials. At their worst, American officials must operate under many legal constraints and face political accountability, and we have considerable legal and political recourse against their abuses. Criminals, however, now operate with virtual impunity, and we have little legal protection against them. Some free marketers have lost all perspective about such things. For instance, one correspondent challenged my thesis that crime was a grave danger to our civilization. He strongly defended the Supreme Court's Miranda ruling, exclusionary rules, and other legal benefits extended to criminals, saying, quote, "A terrifying crisis does indeed exist in the United States, but it is a crisis of uncontrolled government and an exploding law enforcement growth industry," unquote. Through what distorting lens do such self-styled advocates of individual rights view a largely benign government as a greater menace to its citizens than those cold-blooded predators whom it was constituted to pursue and punish? Well, let's be sensible. Having to pay taxes, predictably and non-violently, for a hodgepodge of programs, both good and bad, isn't remotely equivalent to being unpredictably confronted by some sociopath wielding a sawed-off shotgun. Facing the prospect of military conscription with a variety of legal options at your disposal is not remotely as horrifying as being taken hostage by a terrorist or having your child kidnapped from the sidewalk by a serial killer. We lose all credibility with the American people when our abstract concerns and fears are so disproportionate and so removed from the very real threats that they see at hand. Too many of us are so fixated upon government violations of rights that we've forgotten all about non-governmental violations of rights. Knowledgeable defenders of individual rights are simply missing the boat by neglecting the crime issue. If crime isn't violation of individual rights and our aim is to persuade people to grasp the principle of individual rights, doesn't it make sense for us to address this area of intense national concern? Especially when the reforms needed in the criminal justice system are the ones which only our philosophical perspective can supply. One of the most fascinating things I've witnessed in my dealings with crime victims has been how crime has affected their overall political thinking on an array of other issues. In Massachusetts, I saw Irish Catholic and Italian-American housewives alter lifelong liberal democratic voting habits due to their experiences with crime. They had become so incensed with excuses for crime that their sympathies were changing on other related issues. The rebellion against the excuse-making industry became generalized. After all, once the idea is accepted in principle, it's only a matter of time before its implications become apparent. The view that man is a victim of forces beyond his control is the premise undergirding the welfare state. Once people accept the idea that we're all self-responsible, it's a short step for them to begin questioning other aspects of the welfare state and other notions of the excuse-making industry. There are other advantages for us in making crime a front-burner issue. It's less abstract than many other issues, and hence easier to understand. It's deeply personal, hence it motivates people to action. It's an issue in which we have huge natural constituencies, millions of crime victims, their millions of friends and relatives, law enforcement agencies and personnel, victims' rights organizations, and countless worried Americans who live in fear. Perhaps the biggest advantage the crime issue presents us is moral. We are literally on the side of the good guys, and they are literally on the side of the bad guys. Too often, we free marketers are caricatured as ivory tower intellectuals and cold-hearted ideologues, willing to sacrifice real people to our abstract theories and cost-benefit analyses. The welfare state's excuse makers, on the contrary, posture as champions of helpless, bleeding victims. Well, on the crime issue, we are unambiguously the champions of the helpless, bleeding victims, while they, the excuse makers, are cold-heartedly ignoring the victim's plight, even defending their victimizers with abstract theories and cost-benefit analyses. Liberal excuse makers simply don't know what to do when the tables are turned like this. Just ask Mike Dukakis. But I want to make it emphatically clear that I do not view crime victims as mere fodder for propaganda or political agitation. I feel an enormous personal responsibility to those whom I've written about, a responsibility to be their public voice. I'm proud that many of them consider me a friend and that our contacts continue to this day. I've given you facts, arguments, and statistics about crime, but all that tends to depersonalize the issue. It's easy for me to remember what crime is all about. I began by mentioning the faces that have haunted my dreams for 2 years. Let me tell you what I see at night. Crime to me means the ravaged faces of Jim and Paula Danforth telling me how their lovely 19-year-old daughter was attacked and murdered as she walked home from work. Crime to me means the desolate faces of the Fournier family relating how their son Joey was stabbed 19 times by Willie Horton, then dumped in a trash can to die. Crime to me means the stoic face of Clifford Barnes as he tells me how, bound and gagged, he was forced to listen while upstairs Willie Horton raped his wife Angie. Crime to me means the rigid face of Barbara Peterson recounting how she was dragged off her front porch, then savagely beaten and kicked by three juveniles for 15 minutes. Crime to me means the calm face of pretty Cindy Jacobs recalling the day she was kidnapped, then repeatedly raped for 15 hours. Crime to me means the embittered face of Vivian Ruggiero as she describes how her husband John, a police officer, futilely held up his hand to ward off the five fatal bullets that shattered his wedding ring. Crime to me means the tear-streaked face of Lorraine DaCosta, reliving the terrible night when, in the local morgue, she cradled the lifeless body of Stephen, her murdered boy. These and other faces have haunted my dreams and compelled me for the past 2 years to tell their stories, to expose who and what was responsible for their suffering, and I hoped to spare others similar horrors. I would be gratified if crime and consequences could help to change public perceptions about this vital issue. And I'd be grateful in the name of those victims if you'd raise your voices on their behalf. Thank you.
End of part one, a conference on freedom. To hear part two, please change cassettes.